Thank you, John. We are actually still on pace to be able to have a substantial amount of time left for questions, perhaps a miracle attributable to our timing on Sunday morning. But in any case, let me finally introduce Arthur Waldron, who is Lauder Professor of International Relations at the University of...
In the 17th century, if you'll cast your minds back, in 1644, there was a transition of the ruling dynasty in China from the Ming Dynasty to the Qing Dynasty. And for a long time, because these were rather similar in their outward manifestations, they both had Peking as the capital and so forth, there's a tendency to put them together and say there's a continuum, the Ming-Qing continuum. That was what I learned about in graduate school. Well, since that time, it has been observed that one of the things that happened in 1644 when the Qing became the dynasty was that China, in quotation marks, doubled in size. It doubled in size. And if you want to read more about the implications of this, I see that the latest National Interest has an article by my friend Charles Horner that goes into some detail. But one of the implications of this doubling in size was that a lot of areas were incorporated into, under the rule of the new Qing ruling house, that had not previously really been part of the Chinese cultural world. And among these areas were the areas of Turkestan, which were a Turkic in population believed in Islam. Of course, Tibet with Tibetan Buddhism. And one of the issues that developed for the Qing dynasty was how to keep peace in its realms. And I think the answer for the way that they did it was coexistence and separation. But come the 20th century, China was supposed to become, wanted to become, a state like the other states of the world, a nation state. And that meant somehow coming up with a common frame of reference, a common ideology, a common set of values for all of these different groups. And that's where these issues of conflict versus conciliation come in, because it has been very, very difficult to find such a framework. The framework, which was very popular at the turn of the 20th century and is becoming popular again now, is Chinese nationalism. Nationalism, for someone who's a historian like me, this is a very, very complicated word, and I prefer not to use it. People tend to say, well, it's all explained by nationalism. I say, well, that's fine, now please explain nationalism. And it turns out that the all you've done is move the problem by incorporating it into a word. But I was at a meeting in China a couple of years ago, which was presided over by a former foreign minister, and they got talking about, you could see there was lots of inside talk going on. I said, well, China has 55 nationalities. And they're all different, and so forth and so on. But he said a lot of comrades are starting to say, but the leading nationality is the Han nationality. So that's the leading nationality, which are the people who we would, when we say the word Chinese, that's who we mean in Western usage. Even though according to Chinese usage, there are Tibetan Chinese, and there are Turkic Chinese, and Russian Chinese, and so forth. When we say Chinese, we mean the Han. And it's interesting, this former foreign minister was coming down very hard on that. He said, that's wrong. That's not communism. And that brings up the point that that communism is one of the few ideologies that made it possible to unite a lot of people into a single polity, rather in the way that a religion can unite people of differing ethnicities. And when I teach communism, I try to avoid the economics, which is a little bit too difficult for me, and also I gather from some people it doesn't quite always work out mathematically the way it's supposed to. And I try to stress that one of the great appeals of communism in the 20th century was that it was one of the few world organizations which was not basically racist. If you went to the headquarters of the Comintern in Moscow, you would find Mr. Roy, who was an Indian with a very dark complexion. That was unusual, to put it mildly, in any international organization for much of the 20th century. And I think that fact, rather than the particular Marxist doctrines about economics, contributed, made it appealing to lots of people who weren't white. Well, China united itself in the 20th century, for the second half of the 20th century, under communism. And of course, communism is not just an economic and a political ideology, but it's also a militantly atheist. And it's one of the many, China was one of the many places where religion was supposed to disappear. Well, today, it turns out that it hasn't disappeared. In fact, the only religion that I see is really having disappeared in China is communism. There are only a few people who really believe in communism in the way that people even a generation ago, or even when I was in college, believed in it. Even for the leadership, this is it's a hollow. It's a vessel which is just an appearance. And in its place have arisen to fill this sort of vacuum, as it were. There are new sorts of individual belief. Now, Christians in the West know a great deal about what goes on with Christianity in China. There's also great interest in Judaism in China. There are no Chinese Jews left, but my friend Morris Rasabi at Queens University, City University of New York in Queens, makes a very nice additional living just traveling around America, speaking to Jewish groups about the Jews who used to be in China. And it's interesting because the Jews of China really were assimilated, as far as we can tell. I mean, they disappeared, they ceased to have a separate identity. That hasn't happened with Christianity in China. I would say it is deeply rooted in China. It is a Chinese phenomenon. But it is very, very distinct from the society as a whole. In other words, the quality of belief. One of the things about Christianity and Islam, say, as opposed to Buddhism, is that the quality of belief, what calls for from the individual, is somewhat different. And we now know that in the 1970s, when it was made legal to manifest religion again, to practice again in China, everybody was astonished. Both the social scientists abroad and the cadres within China, by the incredible strength. Although the numbers are not great in relative terms, the great strength that Christianity demonstrated. But I think this is an index of something else. I study Christianity partly because it's like a sort of a thermometer that you can use to judge the whole thing. Variations on Buddhism emerged, and most famously is this practice called Falun Gong or Falun Dafa, which is all over the newspapers, which the Communist Party has decided to try to bring down. Just one anecdote about that and about the quality of belief. One of the things that's often said is that followers of Falun Gong are stupid, uneducated people, who don't know anything and are easily, they're easily led, easily dominated, whatever that phrase is. Well, we have at Penn a professor of computer science who's an ethnic Chinese who is a follower of this, and I've talked to him occasionally. The first point to be made is that you don't get to be a professor of computer sciences at Penn by being an idiot. So it shows that this obviously can appeal to somebody who's extremely well-educated, informed, cosmopolitan, and the rest. But the other point I'd like to bring up in connection with him, I asked him, well, why? What about this religion? What about Falun Dafa? Why does it have this appeal? What about the communists? And he said something very interesting. He's a man, probably, I think he's probably about 40. He said, these communists, their heads are full of all kinds of stuff they've imported from Germany and Russia. They don't really know anything about China. They don't understand a really deeply rooted Chinese tradition. And that is one of the reasons that they find us so worrying, because we're tapping in. We're tapping into thousands of years of Chinese culture. And I think that that's true. You've also had a tremendous revival just of a much looser kind of Buddhism, which doesn't make the kind of demands that the Falun Dafa does. And I actually know people, I mean, there are a number of interesting phenomena, conversions from communism to Christianity, from communism to Buddhism. Islam has gotten much, much stronger. I remember traveling in Turkestan. They made a big mistake there. They knocked down all the mosques during the Cultural Revolution. And that was not a good idea if you wanted to try to get the Muslims to be friendly. They've been rebuilt. You can see the dates on them, 1982, 1988, all the rest. But there's a growth of Islamic assertion. So when we look at China, I think we can say that the development of religion there is a factor which poses a very fundamental threat to political control. although I would say that the threat really comes from the fact that the political control overreaches itself. Now, how are we going to deal with this? How does one deal with it? How does one think about going from conflict to conciliation? And this is really the point that I want to make. In the sort of secularizing literature, social science literature that's been referred to, the idea is that you go from sort of religious society to secular society. I've lately become very convinced that what you need in society is you have to have a kind of a clear hierarchy. People have to know where they are, where they belong, what their rights are, and so forth and so on. And most societies were divinely sanctioned hierarchies. But, say, in the United States, we have a hierarchy which is democratically legitimated. And I think that you have to somehow make a shift from the divine sanction to a popular sanction without abandoning order. And I tend to see order or disorder, particularly religious disorder, usually as arising at a time when politics are in flux. And if you look at China today, politics is a huge question mark over the future of China politically. Don't believe somebody who says, oh yeah, the Communist Party's, they've got it in the bag, there's economic reform's going to continue itself. Don't believe that for a minute. I think that there's a huge question mark there, and that's one of the reasons that the religious issue is so potentially explosive. Now, look at India. In India, there's often a sense that, boy, it's going to explode. You know, the Hindus and the Muslims are going to begin killing each other, and it's just going to be Armageddon. And of course, there's some evidence for that, because they periodically do start killing each other. I mean, you have absolute clear evidence that religion can be a fatal fault line in India. And one of the most recent examples, although of course we have the mosque example, Ayodhya, but when Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated, that directly came out of her policy against the Sikhs. I had a student who was, when I was teaching at the War College, who had been at the presidential residence, one of the military officers on duty at the presidential residence when this happened, or the prime minister's residence. And he said, you know, as soon as the word came that Mrs. Gandhi had been killed, they just followed the constitutional procedure. There was no discussion of, you know, should the army take a role? They knew exactly what they were going to do. And this impressed me very much because, say, in China, you have never, ever, in the 20th century, there's never been a peaceful transition of power. Every single transition of power has been extra-constitutional in some sense. And I look at India, and I think, actually, the fact that it is a free country and a democratic country has moderated, it has greatly moderated the potential explosive quality that religion could have. Then I look at a place like Indonesia, where you have real bloodshed. Malaysia was mentioned with Anwar Ibrahim and all the rest. I think to some extent this is a function of political transition. Just to get back to my focus. The first point I think is that religion is in many ways the key to having a civil society. That's true in our own country, that's true in many other countries. And I think it's true in China. The Confucian value system, which was always subtly at odds with political value, was the basis of civil society in China. I think religion can be that again. Now, not only that, I would argue that religion today in China is the first beachhead of civil society in the following sense, that religion was persecuted. And it was also co-opted. And what happened during the period of high totalitarianism was that religion became completely a matter for individuals. So that, say, the Roman Catholic Church continues to exist underground, but it is no longer, and it has a certain hierarchical structure, but it does not have a hierarchical structure that the state can come into and take control of. That one of the things that individuals learned under persecution was how to insulate themselves from the state. So in small pockets, the religious communities in the totalitarian world are the first pieces of the first models of what a free society could be like. Now, of course, in that sense, they are ipso facto threats to the survival, to totalitarianism. That basically is what I have to say. I think that as far as conciliation and conflict go, it's a mistake to see religion as a primary driver of conflict. I think that a larger kind of political disorder lies behind conflict. And that, I think, is true in the West, and it's also true in Asia. And although much of the evidence from Asia is taken as demonstrating that there are sort of deep kind of primal instincts that separate people or there are irreconcilable values, I think that if you look at what's going on in a lot of Asia today, you can make sense of it the way that I have tried to outline, and that is a rather, to my mind, a more encouraging picture. Thank you.